as if he had run a long race, forcing her to breathe in the flat smell of brandy and cigars that escaped from him as she could not.
"Merci, ma chère," he said raggedly, but he still didn't move.
When at last he got up from her, careful not to get mud on himself, he looked away and busied himself straightening his clothes.
"You better go back now and join the party," he said.
It was over. Suzette looked down, and even in the dull moonlight she could see that her beautiful white dress was streaked with traces of scarlet. She would need to wash it out in secret, she thought, make sure her mother never saw the stains. She needed to figure out how to change her dress and go back to the party before she was missed, what to do next. She wanted to ask the doll man his advice. The cold of the night pressed in as she waited for him to initiate some further connection, but he made no move toward her, had nothing else to say. Uncertain, with Eugène's back still to her, she forced herself up and started to walk in the direction of the music, listening for a sound, any sound, that would tell her the proper thing to do. There were party noises in the distance, festive sounds. She heard night calls from the woods, skittering creatures out prowling for food or trying to avoid becoming some bigger prey's next meal. There were river noises, gentle and soothing, as the edges of the water lapped at the red banks of the shore in the centuries-old ceremony of give and take. But all that Suzette could make out was a sound just this side of hearing, like dreams drifting out of reach, slight as a soft spring wind. Chapter 4. The March winds arrived with an abrupt ferocity, buffeting the land and the workers in the field with equal determination. Before daybreak each morning, the quarter emptied out and labor gangs split off and headed in separate directions, some holding down their hats, others with the wind whipping at the hems of their long, threadbare skirts. A set went off to the east, leading the oxen to lip up the cotton lots and to prepare the new season's beds for corn and potatoes. Another took off to the west to burn logs, shrub, and cut down last year's corn stalks. Even the quarter-hands and half-hands were pressed into service until dusk to pick up and clear the spent corn stalks or gather the manure behind the animals. By first weeding 4 weeks later, a hint of the coming warmth had begun to work its way inside the chill of the heavy Louisiana air. Suzette stayed low in the bushes and watched her sister Palmyre and the other hoe women off in the distance, trudging out to the fields, balancing their heavy hoes over their shoulders. First light from the rising sun glinted off the heads of the hoes, broad as shovels and hammered out of pig iron. The tool took tremendous strength to lift and skill to manage, and her sister was considered one of the best. Deaf and dumb was not a liability in clearing weeds and thinning the newly sprung cotton seedlings. A sour odor rose from the mass at Suzette's feet, threatening to wrench her stomach again, and she pushed herself up. It was the fourth time this week she had been forced out to the bushes before the plantation bell rang. There was breakfast to prepare, but all she wanted was to lie down right where she was, close her eyes, and sleep. A morning breeze helped center her. Eugène Dorat was coming again today. He had become a regular visitor of the Durbans, bringing her small things from time to time and giving them to her in the woods. A leftover piece of cloth from his store for a kerchief, a hard candy, the stump of a candle. In the big house, she was invisible to him. Since the quarter Christmas party, he sought her out whenever it struck his fancy. He would tell her to meet him after supper at the rock, or to wait for him beyond the edge of the piney woods in the afternoon, and she would go. He barely spoke, and he did not expect her to do much of anything except lie or stand until he was finished with her. Each time they were together in that way, he would say, "Merci, ma chère." Suzette tried to figure out what the doll man meant by those words. If he was thanking her, did that mean he thought she had a say in whether or not to obey his instruction to meet him?
that she could say out loud that she did not want to lie down in secret while he fumbled and sometimes hurt her. Ma chère. No matter how often she played back the words, trying to hear a new tone or emphasis, his true intent was just beyond her grasp. Was she dear to him? When she went to him, she transported herself to the smooth rhythm of shelling peas while her mother hummed in the cookhouse, or the sleepy-eyed reassurance of Nicolas Moulin's face, just until he stopped moving on her and it was time to get back to work. Questioning him was unthinkable. He was a grown man, a white man, and a close friend of the Durbans. She couldn't talk to her mother. She couldn't talk to Orline, who prattled on about her older cousin Eugène's visits, how interesting he was, how entertaining. The secret rendezvous were not like the prickly tingling Nicolas Moulin could set off in her. Those feelings scared her too, but they had been full of possibilities. This was heavy, like the old rotted oak tree she had seen fall across the road near the front gate, that took days and many men to carve up and move aside. She thought about talking to Palmyre about the tangle of hope, despair, and emptiness that came to her whenever she saw Eugène Dorat, or even heard his name, but there were no signs in the language they had created between them to describe these feelings. What could her sister tell her, even if she could speak? Palmyre had her own worries with Louis Durban's nighttime visits. It was months before she stopped puzzling over the hidden meaning of Eugène Dorat's "Merci, ma chère." The words meant only that he was done with her, and it was time for her to go away and resume her chores under Françoise's watchful eye in the big house, or her mother's in the cookhouse. But her daily routine had come to seem small and meaningless next to this other thing that was spreading out and taking hold of her body. She wondered if either Françoise or her mother, who both seemed to be able to see the smallest thing out of place in the big house, could see this too. When her birthday month came around again in the summer, she would be 14. She could still recall the delicious taste of turning 9, when it was possible to strike out in a direction of her own choosing, and Orline and Narcisse would follow, open to whatever came next. It had begun to feel like a suspect memory that must have happened to someone else. "Pay attention to what you're doing," Françoise snapped, catching Suzette on the side of the head with her knuckles. Lately she was getting as many swats, slaps, and pinches as Palmyre used to when she worked in the house, before she had been banished to the field. Suzette burned the bread. She scorched one of Louis Durban's shirt collars and mixed up the salt and sugar. The delicate blue-and-white figurine in the front room that Eugène Dorat had brought as a gift from France had smashed into so many pieces when she dropped it that there was no hope of repair. She forgot to clean out the wall altar in the Durban's bedroom. Her life had traveled far beyond her understanding. The picture in her mind of standing in front of St. Augustine with Nicolas Moulin and being married by a real priest was obviously hopeless. Try as she might, she couldn't create an image of a future with Eugène Dorat in it. He could never marry her, even if he wanted to. Not only was it against the law, it was unspeakable. She had no new dreams to replace her old ones. The longer she hid her secret, the greater the distance between her and everyone else, as if they were all on the close side of Cane River, and she was on the opposite bank, alone. The thought of the baby frightened her, but gave her comfort, too. It was a concrete thing that belonged only to her. Suzette let each day drift, holding on to time. Shortly after the cotton reached a foot high in the field, Elizabeth cornered her in the cookhouse.
"Looks like you're eaten for more than one, Suzette."
"Uh-huh," Suzette answered from her faraway place.
"Who's the man?"
Suzette brought herself back, eyeing her mother cautiously.
"What do you mean?" she stammered.
"You can't hide it. Who's the man?"
"I did not want to, Mère."
"Is he white?"
Suzette tried to speak and found she could not. She stared down at her hands.
The world didn't start with you, Suzette. I've been through it. In Virginia with the master's son before coming here.
Elizabeth put down the rolling pin.
It's Eugene Dora, isn't it? Looking at you like you're some new Louisiana sweetmeat to try.
Yes, Suzette said in a small voice.
Did he hurt you?
Not much after the first time. I don't know. He chose me.
Elizabeth let out a low moan, a strangled sound steeped in resignation.
Oh, baby girl, she said.
What do I do now? Suzette asked.
Your stomach twist up in the morning?
Yes, ma'am.
This baby's already caught. We wait for the quickening to make sure it's gonna stay caught.
Elizabeth came around the work table and pulled Suzette close, wrapping her big arms around Suzette's shoulders, rocking her slowly from side to side. Suzette stiffened, but Elizabeth didn't let go. After a time, Suzette sank into the warmth and smells of her mother and they rocked together.
This is what our life is, baby girl. It didn't stop me from loving those babies of mine in Virginia.
An urgent coldness shot through Suzette. She did not want to hear what had happened to her mother. She pushed herself away, picked up the sharp kitchen knife, and busied herself chopping the okra, separating the hard green caps from the stalks on the cutting board. Elizabeth turned to stir the stew simmering in the kettle.
If I can see your condition, it won't be long before others do, too. When that Frenchman comes at you again, you tell him about this baby, that he should be leaving you alone now. We need to make sure that Madame knows that it wasn't Monsieur. You turn up with a high yellow baby without warning, there's no telling what she could do. It's bad enough trying to keep Palmyre away from her. You just do your work. I'll go to her tomorrow.
Françoise left a trail of damp footprints as she came into the stranger's room, where Suzette had just finished scrubbing the floorboards. Françoise stared openly at the beginnings of a gentle rounding under the fabric of Suzette's thin gingham dress.
"Elizabeth came to see me," she began stiffly. "You were brought up better. We did not give permission for you to start a family yet. Who is the father?"
Suzette hung her head.
"You hear me, girl? I didn't bring you up to the house so you could slide back and be like Palmyre. Who is the father?"
Françoise's tone had become loud and insistent, and she grabbed Suzette's arm. They were alone in the room, and Suzette was suddenly afraid.
"It was Monsieur Duroy. He told me not to say anything," Suzette said quietly.
Françoise gripped her more tightly.
"It wasn't anyone from Rosedew."
"No, madame, I'm sure."
"Has there been anyone else? Do not lie to me or I can get you put out to field like your sister."
Françoise's narrowed eyes were menacing.
"There's only been Monsieur Dora," Suzette said, her voice small and timid.
Françoise loosened her hold.
"Another little mulatto mouth to feed."
Françoise spat out the word mulatto, as though she had gotten hold of one of the bitter herbs she used for doctoring.
"We gave you every opportunity, Suzette. This is not the Christian way. You people cannot help yourselves, I suppose."
"Oui, madame."
Suzette had trouble concentrating on her work for the rest of the day, afraid of what would come next. She was jittery throughout the evening, just wanting to lie down on her pallet without having to face anyone else, answer any more questions.
"You are so quiet, Suzette,"
Arline said that evening when the two girls were alone in the bedroom.
"Is anything wrong?"
"No, mademoiselle."
"You have been acting odd of late. You can tell me. I tell you everything."
"There's nothing, mademoiselle."
"It's first Friday," Arline said conspiratorially. "Are you ready?"
"Yes, mademoiselle."
Aureline became solemn. Unsmiling, she extended her bare right foot and touched the flat of her heel to the wooden base of the four-poster bed, closing her eyes.
today. The first Friday of the month, I place my foot on the footboard and I pray the great Saint Nicholas to make me meet the one I am to marry, she recited soberly. Then she jumped into her bed without touching the floor, lay down on her right side, her hand over her heart, and made herself still so she could fall asleep without talking, without laughing, without moving. Suzette lowered the mosquito bar over her and blew out the candles. The next morning, as Suzette came back from the cookhouse, she almost ran into Françoise in the narrow hallway coming out of Arline's room. "Suzette!" Françoise said tautly as she brushed past, and Suzette dropped her eyes and curtsied. Arline was standing beside the armoire, and Suzette went over to help her tighten the stays in her corset, trying to gauge Arline's mood. Arline seemed sulky and silent, anger collecting in her face as if it were building up to a storm. "Aunt Françoise told me about the baby," she said, her words clipped. There was nothing for Suzette to say. She removed Arline's gray and black plaid dress from the armoire.
"Why did you go with him?"
"I can only do what I am told, mademoiselle."
"How long has it been going on? Since he came to Cane River?"
The on-the-edge pitch Suzette recognized from childhood was mixed with something new.
"He found me alone at Christmas time," Suzette said tiredly.
"What did you do to make him come to you?"
"He followed me. I did nothing. I was wearing my christening dress."
Suzette didn't know why she had added the last part, as if what she was wearing mattered.
"Did you want to make a baby with him?" Arline pushed.
"No."
"Did you tell him that?"
"No."
"If you didn't want this to happen, why didn't you say anything?"
"I don't know."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I don't know, mademoiselle."
"I tell you everything important that happens to me."
The new tone again.
"I could have helped you. I've always been the one to help you."
"What could you have done?" Suzette asked, her tongue heavy and dull. "What could anyone have done?"
"You didn't even tell me. Aunt Françoise knew before I did."
Arline's voice broke, midway between a whine and an accusation. She turned her face away, and several minutes passed before she spoke again.
"Don't think for a minute that now that you've been found out, you can come to me for anything," Arline said haughtily. "I need for you to get my bonnet. I'm going out visiting with Aunt Françoise today."
Suzette was dismissed from Arline's heart. Suzette carried the full coffee service into the front room and set it down with care on the sideboard. Her belly jutted out bigger and rounder than the ripe watermelons they cracked open in summer, and cramps had stitched her in waves all morning. Slowly, with effort, she moved across the room and placed freshly pressed white linen napkins in the laps of Arline and Françoise.
"We'll have to bring Afia in soon to replace Suzette,"
Françoise remarked to Arline.
"Louis won't spare Palmyre from the field."
Suzette began to pour steaming coffee into the fragile cups, allowing her thoughts to linger on the pleasing idea of 30 days away from the big house in Palmyre's cabin after the baby came. Arline gave a sideways glance at Suzette.
"You know, Aunt Françoise, I intend to miss Cousin Eugène desperately when he leaves. He's my favorite dance partner."
Suzette listened, as she knew Arline intended her to. She knew nothing of Eugène Dora leaving. Arline no longer confided in her about the comings and goings of Cane River's Creoles.
"He'll come back to us when he finishes his business in France,"
Françoise said, leaning forward to settle her sewing kit on the side table.
"With wonderful presents, no doubt."
Suzette watched Françoise's napkin slide in a deliberate line from her lap to a tangle near her feet. With an awkward twist, she bent toward the floor to retrieve the cloth. Deep inside, something shifted, and Suzette felt a warm gushing down her thighs.
"Oh,
The sound escaped before she could stop it.
I think it's my time, she moaned.
Panicky, she looked up at Françoise. Françoise sprang to her feet, ordering Orline to get old Bertram in the wagon. Suzette remembered being taken down to Palmier's cabin in the quarter. She remembered waiting for the midwife to arrive, and she remembered the curious taste of the cloves and whiskey Françoise offered. More than anything else, for the next 24 hours, Suzette remembered the pain. Afternoon dragged into evening. They lit candles and waited, the midwife next to Suzette wiping her forehead and neck with a damp rag, and Françoise sitting on a straight-backed pine chair by the fireplace, her shawl gathered around her shoulders. Overseeing the birth of slaves was her responsibility on Rosedew, and she took her role seriously. Elizabeth brought a simple supper for the two women, and a pot of copal moss soaked in boiling water for Suzette. Françoise poured whiskey in the pot, and the women got Suzette to drink it down. They waited. Suzette's screams pierced the dark night of quiet in the quarter, and still the baby had not come with the ringing of the plantation bell the next morning. A little before noon, a baby boy finally emerged in a spill of earthen color, dappled with red. They wrapped him in his new blanket and handed him to Suzette. His name will be Philomon from the Bible, Suzette thought. But she could focus on his buff-colored face for only the briefest moment before she descended into an all-consuming sleep. The sun had gone down by the time Suzette woke. She smelled the biting scent of laurel leaves on Elizabeth's hands as her mother shook her firmly by the shoulders and she struggled to open her eyes. For a moment, as Elizabeth's dark and unchanging face came into focus, Suzette felt safe. Palmier was near the fireplace, just in from the field, sweat and tiredness still clinging to her. She moved heavily on her feet as she ground a corn paste for ash cakes, her belly bulging. Palmier's own child would be coming soon. Suzette stared at the whimpering bundle next to her on the cot. "Time to feed your boy," Elizabeth prodded, opening the front of Suzette's shirt waist and settling the fretting baby at Suzette's breast. He fussed for only a minute before finding Suzette's nipple and pulling at it greedily. "His name is Philemon," Suzette announced weakly, looking down at the contorted face, stroking the fine dark hair plastered to his head. "They gonna call this one Jérôme," Elizabeth said. "Madame already gave him the name."
"But he's mine," Suzette said shakily.
"His out loud name is Jérôme," Elizabeth repeated deliberately. "That has to fit him."
Elizabeth crossed the room to the fireplace and tapped Palmier on the shoulder to get her attention, then made a drinking motion with her hands. Palmier nodded, poured steaming liquid from the small dented pot over the hot coals into a cup, and handed it to Elizabeth. Elizabeth came back to the cot where Suzette nursed the baby.
"This laurel tea will do you good, and Palmier will have supper up directly," Elizabeth said, bringing the cup to Suzette's lips. "You must be starving."
She tucked the blanket around the infant.
"We love all our children in this family, no matter how they come to us. You be careful not to roll over that baby. Palmier will show you what you need to know. I can't stay."
Long after she left, Suzette stared through half-shut eyes at the closed door, until Palmier took the baby away and brought the ash cakes. For the next few days, the constant thread weaving in and out of Suzette's wake sleep was Jérôme, always crying. Suzette cried, too. It became difficult to tell the difference. She couldn't walk or sit up in bed in the same position for long, and the thoughts that had always chased one another around in her head were gone. There was only sleep, pain, nursing, rocking, and more crying. Her sister's cabin became a meeting place, and she had visitors from the quarter and from the big house, bringing advice, food, or a sweet tit for Jérôme. Even Aureline came, a worried look on her face, repeating over and over that everything would be all right, holding Suzette's hand as she drifted back to sleep.
Voices drifted in and out of her awareness, advising her how to tell the difference between this cry and that cry. But Geron's wailing vibrated deep to her core and communicated nothing but endless need. He accused her with each breath he took. Whenever he pushed away her breast, Suzette knew that he wanted someone else more worthy to be his mother. Exhausted, Suzette slept through much of it. She resisted the talk around her, but whispers pierced the cushion of her sleep, and she heard them anyway.
"All that fancy talking dress, up at the big house acting like she belonged there, but she's come home to her own," they said.
Elizabeth came every night and walked with Geron, humming familiar lullabies. Palmyra used her strong arms as if she were swinging the hoe and wordlessly rocked Geron into peace. Suzette fell deeper into her failures, heavy-hearted in the face of how she had disappointed everyone. For the first 3 weeks after Geron's birth, life was an expanding panorama of ruined dreams and expectations. Suzette got down on her hands and knees to scour underneath the dining-room table with a stiff brush and sudsy water, taking care to clean between the floorboard cracks. Louis d'Herban had taken to dropping his food and drink wherever he happened to be, and there seemed always to be a wet spot or hardened crust Suzette needed to get to before Françoise found it. It seemed as if everything had changed in the 60 days since Geron was born. Every minute of her day was filled with someone pulling at her, trying to take possession of her hands, her breast, her mind, or her heart. Louis had been an old man for a long time already, but he seemed more fragile to Suzette now, like one of the d'Herban's fine cracked dishes that had to be handled with extra care because it was too good to throw out. It fell to Suzette to put him on and lift him off the bedpan and to wash him. She hand-fed him special foods that he could chew and keep down. He seldom rode out to the field anymore, preferring to sit on the front gallery with his bottle of bourbon, nursing a tumbler full of the dark brown liquid, and she cleaned up after him when his weakened stomach rebelled. Orléans entered the dining room in a flurry of impatience.
"There you are! I can't find my lace gloves," she complained to Suzette.
"They're up on the top shelf of the armoire where they're supposed to be, mademoiselle," Suzette said, her hands stung from the hot water. Orléans paused as if in a debate with herself.
"It's good to have you back. I know she's your sister, but Afia didn't have good house sense," she said in the soft, accepting tone of long ago. "She never got my hair right."
"I'll find the gloves," Suzette said. She got to her feet and put the pail aside. Orléans followed Suzette back to the bedroom, and Suzette used the step stool to reach the gloves.
"If you don't need me further, mademoiselle, it's been 3 hours." "Go on, then," Orléans said, indulgence edging her tone. "Do your business."
Suzette hurried down the path to the cookhouse, and she heard Geron's loud, blustery cry before she got to the door. He was hungry. A staccato whimper meant he was uncomfortable. A rolling howl begged for attention. Elizabeth was chopping vegetables at the work table when she came in. She looked up at Suzette and went on with her work. Suzette sat down and brought Geron to her breast, mother and son in their quiet time. Her thoughts turned to her own mother. Since Geron, Suzette had begun to think of Elizabeth as the strongest link in a growing chain. Blessedly, her mother was still strong and healthy and in firm control of the cookhouse. Eugène Dorat returned from his 3-month trip to France, just as the persimmons were ripening red-orange on the south field trees. He brought back a delicate figurine for Françoise to replace the one that Suzette had broken, a bottle of Madeira for Louis, and a fashionable bonnet with festive green streamers for Orléans. The d'Herbans gave a party to celebrate his return to Cane River, and Suzette served. Each day flowed into the next, and Rosedew returned to its routines. On a late summer day, when Geron was nearly a year old, Eugène caught Suzette alone out behind the spring house as she was carrying back a pail of water for the house.
"Suzette, go to the rock this afternoon after supper. I will meet you there.
He used the honeyed voice of possession, but Suzette had fallen out of the practice of considering her trysts with Eugène to be part of her duties on Rosedew.
Monsieur Duras, I have to get things ready for the soirée tonight. There is no time. Madame Françoise is waiting on me. It is impossible to get away today.
The mention of Françoise's name put him off, but she knew it was only a postponement. Her mother had gone to Françoise once to ask for help. She could not go again. It was up to Suzette from now on. It reminded her of cats with the mice they caught around Rosedew, toying with their food before they ate it. After the first capture, they would pretend to let the mouse go on its way, pulling back just enough to encourage hope. Only then would they shoot out the fast paw, or deliver a quick nip to the neck, trapping it once again into the game. She had once watched an old tomcat get careless near the smokehouse. The mouse had dashed to freedom, damaged, probably easy game for the next predator, but it had gotten away. Escape was unlikely, but it was possible. Chapter 5. Suzette almost envied Louis his contentment. He liked to stare out for hours while he sat on the gallery in his rocker, cup balanced in his hand, at one with the motion of the chair. He seemed to lean his mind into the landscape, his eyes scanning the scope of Rosedew, the muscles around his mouth locked in an expression of permanent amusement. From time to time he would push himself out of the rocker with his frail arms, carelessly dropping the tin cup they had decided to give him after so many broken glasses. With a great sense of purpose, he would first stand erect, testing the uncertainty of his knees, and then limp away stiff-legged on his own beyond the boundaries of the house. No one ever knew where he was going or why he was in such a hurry to get there. Suzette supposed he was answering a special call that only he could hear. Perhaps he was on his way to meet some cronies for a friendly smoke and a drink, or off to give instruction on the running of his plantation. But before long, he would forget why he had started out, or where he should go next. Everyone on Rosedew and on the surrounding plantations had become used to seeing Louis alone and seemingly bemused, suddenly appearing in new and unexpected places. Before his mind had gotten so clouded, he would turn most often toward the quarter, and the familiarity of Palmyre's cabin, whether she was there or not. But that phase passed and he branched farther out. Once he got as far as Henry Herzog's barn. Whoever found him would lead him back to the big house on Rosedew, turning him over to Suzette. He seldom resisted or argued, and was content with whatever companionship was offered on the leisurely journey back to where he had started. His wandering lessened as arthritis settled in his knees, and the time came when Louis d'Urban never left the front gallery at all. As he approached the seventh decade of his life, they all had to face the reality that he was dying. It was as if a protective cloak had been pulled away from the plantation and exposed the temperamental nature of the delicate machinery underneath. There was not a single position that would be the same without the continued labored breath of the master of Rosedew. It had been years since Louis had ridden across his land, tall in the saddle. The day-to-day affairs of the field had long been turned over to a succession of overseers, and life in the quarter was grinding and capricious. But Louis d'Urban's presence on the front gallery of the big house still had meaning, defining an imaginary point below which things could not sink. He died in his sleep with his affairs in order, leaving a respectable sum for the Catholic Church, as well as declaring his love and recognition of his faithful and loving spouse, Françoise Rachel d'Urban. All of his goods that remained after Françoise's death were to be divided among Aureline and two of his other favorite godchildren. It was the other story that spread quickly through the quarter. Louis d'Urban had freed three of his slaves in his will. One was an old family servant inherited from his father, beyond working age, and the other two were his own natural children by a slave woman who had died years before. But he had not freed his three children
by Palmyre. Françoise took to her sickbed for 2 weeks after the reading of the will. Without Louis on Rosedew, she was just one more unschooled widow along Cane River. Without Louis, Orléans had lost yet another of the male protectors she needed to marry well and take her place in Cane River Creole society. And without Louis d'Herbane, dreams of promised freedom and humane treatment in the quarter died a quick and suffocating death, like a sputtering fire that can't get enough air to keep itself burning. Eugène proved to be a pillar of strength for Françoise and Orléans. He stayed on Rosedew for 4 weeks after Louis died, helping Françoise adjust to running a plantation as large as Rosedew alone. She could neither read nor write, and was without the youthful enthusiasm to take on new challenges. As was the way along Cane River, the extended family formed a tight protective circle around the widow. Between the d'Herbans, Frédieux, and Rachals, a steady stream of visitors came daily to Rosedew to keep her company, play cards, bring gossip, and help oversee business affairs. Suzette had done her best to avoid being alone with Eugène, trying to keep out of his way. She made up one excuse after another why she could not meet him when he wanted, but he was such a regular on Rosedew now that she could not always keep her distance. Their rendezvous were less frequent, but over the months his insistence was impossible to escape. Suzette approached her meetings with Eugène Dorat with the same state of mind she had when cleaning the outhouse. The task had to be performed from time to time, and when finished, she could go on to other things she didn't mind as much. She no longer looked for hidden signals or explanations, and the fewer words exchanged, the better. By first picking, Suzette knew another baby was due in the spring. Eugène's mood for starting something new seemed to follow the schedule for the planting of the new cotton crop. On a sunless, soggy day in September, Eugène commanded her to meet him in the barn after supper. This time she didn't try to avoid him. Suzette sat out in the beating rain and got to the darkened barn first. She swung open the wide door and closed it carefully behind her. The horses and mules were already bedded for the night, but the wind and rain made them edgy, and they pawed at the earth in their stalls. A small hole in the roof off in the far corner let in a steady dripping of rain on the hay beneath. She waited for Eugène there in the dark, hoping no one was looking for her. The moldy scent of the damp hay was sickening, and the barn was drafty and cold. When at last the barn door swung open, she made out a shapeless form slipping inside furtively. Only when the door was fastened again did Eugène light the kerosene lamp he had brought. He struck a matchstick against the match safe, and the horses whinnied nervously. He turned the wick on the lamp down low, dimming the flame, and set the lamp down near the door.
"Where are you?" he called out.
Suzette squeezed out her courage. "Monsieur Eugène, it's about the boy, Giron." Eugène grunted, giving her no encouragement. He began loosening his pants as he moved toward her.
"If you freed him now, he could have a different life. He's your blood."
The wind made a shrill noise as it thrust the rain against the roof.
"And there's another child on the way."
Suzette watched Eugène's hands freeze on his trouser buttons, his face clouded.
"Who says it's mine?"
he got out at last. As if anyone would want her as long as he had his mark on her, Suzette thought.
"It's yours, monsieur. Another boy, I'd say, by the kicking."
He hadn't even noticed her rounding belly.
"They both could be bought out as soon as this one is born and raised free. I've seen it happen."
Eugène didn't answer, staring at her. He hesitated for only a few moments, and then he nimbly buttoned his pants back up. Without a word, he picked up the lamp and went back out into the rain, leaving Suzette in the darkness. From that day forward, her prayers of the last 2 years were answered. He left her alone. Suzette asked Françoise on a Friday to be allowed to go to early mass the following Wednesday, promising to make up her chores later.
Indifferently, Françoise gave her a pass to attend St. Augustine alone. Before the plantation bell rang, Suzette put on her checkered calico Josie and set out for the long walk in the dark. Mass had started by the time she arrived, and Suzette quickly picked out her Marraine Doralise's sorrel mare and brown buggy. She stood quietly, waiting for the service to end. At last, the church began to empty out its early morning worshippers, and she saw Doralise coming toward the buggy with her daughter Elisida and Azénor Metoyer, the Jean de couleur libre Elisida was engaged to marry. Suzette was relieved that Doralise's husband Philippe was not there. There was something about him that frightened her. Even with downcast eyes, Suzette managed to admire her godmother's profile as the three approached the carriage. Doralise was a dignified, well-bred woman, everything Suzette wished she could be. As Doralise got closer, she turned stiffly toward Suzette in welcome. Suzette quickly looked away from the expanding circles of puffy, dark flesh that formed petals around one of Doralise's eyes. The gossip must be true, that Philippe had taken to beating Doralise so often and acting so strangely, that even his own high and mighty family was considering locking him up somewhere. Doralise's face reminded Suzette of a ripe peach that she had once found on the ground in the big garden, seemingly so perfect until she'd picked it up and exposed an oozing, rotten wound on the underside. "Good morning, Suzette. I wouldn't have expected to see you here. Did you need to talk to me?" Doralise asked. The bruise distracted Suzette. Stammering, she began anyway. "Marraine Doralise, I'm going to have another baby. I want to ask you to be his godmother." "Another baby?" Doralise asked with some surprise, but not unkindly. "Is it the same circumstance as before with Gérard?" Suzette felt herself go hot. "Yes, madame," she forced herself to say. She would have liked to turn around and begin the long walk back home, but the baby had to come before her pride. He would need more protection than she could give. Doralise was a free-colored woman, one of the ones with last names. She had land, money, and slaves of her own. "I think this is another boy," Suzette offered. Doralise turned her head slowly, and her breath caught as if with pain. "Suzette, you must be more careful. This is your second baby, and what are you, 15, 16? Suzette pricked the bubble of bitterness before it had a chance to rise. As much as she loved Gérard, as much as she would do to protect the new life inside her, their making had nothing to do with how careful she was allowed to be. "I'll be 17 come harvest. I do what I'm told, madame. I can't do more. This baby is coming, and he needs someone who can help him, like you promised my mother you would help me before I was born." Doralise's face softened. She gave more of a grimace than a smile. "Yes, I will be godmother to your baby, Suzette." There was nothing else for them to say. Elisida was already high above them, waiting impatiently in the buggy with Azénor Metoyer, carefully looking away from her mother and the girl-woman slave. They were clearly waiting for Doralise to finish talking so they could go home to their own life, a very different life.
"Merci, madame."
Suzette backed away and began the 5-mile trip back home to Rosedew. If this baby could not have a last name, at least it would have protection from someone who did. Suzette and Elizabeth were in the cookhouse together when the contractions began to grip Suzette's body.
"Mère, this one's in a hurry," Suzette said.
Elizabeth gloved her hand and moved the heavy kettle from its hook to another farther away from the hottest flames in the fireplace. She took Suzette by the arm and walked her slowly down the path to the quarter. They stopped whenever the contractions came again. It was early afternoon and almost everyone was in the field. By the time they got to Aunt Jeanne's cabin, Suzette was panting heavily, unable to let go of Elizabeth's arm. Aunt Jeanne sat on her pine stump on the front porch, an infant asleep in a wooden box at her feet.
three small children looked up from playing in a muddy puddle. "It's her time," Elizabeth said to the old woman, nodding toward Suzette. "Send one of the children to let Madame and the midwife know." A light-skinned little boy in a shapeless shirt-tail smock trailed Elizabeth and Suzette as they made their way farther down the road to Palmier's cabin, built a small distance away from the others at Louis d'Herban's command.
"Why are you going to my house, Mame?"
the boy asked as Elizabeth helped Suzette inside the empty cabin.
"Go on back to Aunt Jean-Paul," Elizabeth said. "We have women's business, and you stay out of sight when Madame comes down here."
There were two cots in the room, one for Palmier and the other for her three children. Suzette eased herself onto Palmier's cot and pulled the blanket over her, waiting for the next contraction. There were several split logs and some kindling inside, and Elizabeth started a fire in the fireplace.
"I'll be back directly," Elizabeth said to Suzette, turning to go out again. "I need to go get some copper moss to brew your tea for the pain."
"Don't leave me, mère," Suzette begged. "Please! He's coming now!"
Elizabeth propped up Suzette's knees where she lay on the cot, fanning back the blanket to get a better look.
"He sure enough is," she said.
Giron's birth had been all exhaustion and pain, and by the time he came out into the light, Suzette had been sliding into a darkness of her own. With his second child, it was as if the process were in reverse. It was the baby who took the lead, and when it emerged head first, Suzette was alert and wide awake.
"Not a boy at all," Elizabeth said. "Quick as lightning, and you got yourself a girl."
Elizabeth brought the baby up close to Suzette's face and placed her in Suzette's trembling arms. Suzette saw the thick blue cord of life that connected her to a girl child.
"What's wrong with her?"
Suzette could hear the hysteria in her own voice. The baby was gray.
"Don't worry," Elizabeth said. "The color will turn. We just don't know what direction yet."
From outside came sounds of a buggy and voices. Françoise and the midwife arrived breathless at Palmier's cabin almost at the same time.
"Philomène already got here,"
Suzette said to Françoise as soon as they came through the door. She looked down at the face of the little gray baby with tiny blue fingernails and dark matted hair that clung to her like a helmet.
"Philomène is a boy's name," Françoise said.
"Philomène, then,"
Suzette said with as much faith as she could muster.
"That fits a girl."
Françoise nodded. The name held. Suzette drowsed one Saturday evening as she breastfed Philomène in Palmier's dark cabin. The space was cramped, overflowing with life. She and Palmier slept together on the same cot, nose to toe, each with her nursing infant girl. They had put Palmier to work in the west field, closest to the quarter, after her lay-in month, and she was allowed to come back three times during the day to nurse her own baby girl, Mélantine. The three boys were already asleep on the other cot, a tangle of arms and legs. Giron, who was almost three, got along well with Palmier's boys, Paul, four, and Soleil, too. But Giron had taken to clinging to Suzette all of the time, unused to having his mother so available. She tried not to think about how it would be after the month was up, and the d'Urbans owned her time again in the big house. She was still amazed that Giron and Philomène had come from her. She tried to identify a future in their expressions that could carry them beyond a two-footed ox for the field or an invisible breeder who would disappear into a big house. They didn't look alike at all. It was too early to tell how Philomène's features would fix themselves, the final color of her eyes or hair or skin, but already Suzette could see that in appearance, at least, Philomène favored Eugène Dorat. She had thin fingers and delicate features, a high yellow baby with a sharp nose and a full, thick head of wiry hair that stood up at peculiar, spiky angles. Outside the cabin, a small group gathered, eager to share evening gossip, and she picked out the low hum of familiar voices. Her sister Afia, her brother Solataire, Eliza, and old Bertram. Their voices drifted in and found her.
He beat up on her one too many times, almost killed her twice. After he pulled the knife, she went on up to the Natchitoches courthouse and asked for what they call a divorce. That puts the marriage to the side official. They wouldn't give a colored woman leave to quit her husband, no matter how crazy Monsieur Philippe is. I tell you, they gave her papers to carry back, papers that say she's not married to him anymore. Go on. White folks aren't gonna side with a colored woman. I don't care if she is free. She had help. What kind of help?
From a white man looking to take Philippe's place, but without it going through any church this time.
Who?
Eugène Dora, that Frenchman always coming round here.
Suzette came fully awake. Her godmother Doralise and Eugène Dora? How could that be? Chapter 6
Françoise pushed herself up higher against the pillows in the middle of her four-poster bed, listening to the steady drone of Orléans' voice as her niece read aloud to her. She wasn't well, hadn't felt truly well for years. In mind and body, she was as brittle as the two thinning plaits of white hair that Suzette brushed out and rebraided for her every morning. Her hands were busy with her needlework, but her mind had trouble keeping up with the passages as Aureline spoke them. The overseer had requested an audience with her this morning on a matter, he had said, of grave importance, and she dreaded the intrusion, anticipating the worst. She silently cursed Louis for leaving her alone with too many responsibilities, for allowing the plantation slide that had started long before he died. Rosedew still straddled Bayou Derban, and stretched across both sides of Cane River, as far north as Old River, but the plantation had steadily shrunk. It infuriated her still that during the flush times her husband had given pieces of their land away to his freed mulatto children, including Doralise, and had sold even more in the panic of 1837. After Louis died, Françoise had been forced to sell additional parcels just to make ends meet. Now there was less than 800 acres left, and fewer than 30 slaves. At first, after Louis' death, Françoise had tried to take charge of everything that needed to be done, to run the fields and the house, to maintain the religious and social calendar of Rosedew, to visit in the community. But by the time her girl Suzette came back to work after her second child, Françoise had retreated, had begun to live her life from her bedroom. It was more than she could manage to respond to all of the requests that came flying at her from all directions, demanding decisions. "A pity," they said in front parlors up and down the river. She knew how they spoke of her. "Poor Françoise never did get over Louis' death." Rosedew had taken blows that Françoise did not know how to reverse or correct. Each year seemed to bring a new set of problems. One year, the rains came too early. The next, poison grass choked out part of the crop. The cotton gin broke and cost $300 to repair. They never seemed to have enough money from one year's crop to breathe into the next after paying for food, clothes, seed, machinery, and tools, and the times were against them. When their troubles were at their worst, the banks had stopped lending money to almost everyone. Françoise had relied on Louis to take care of running the business at Rosedew, and he had in turn relied on her to keep the house running smoothly. That arrangement had suited Françoise's sensibilities perfectly, but she was too old and unprepared to take on Rosedew all alone. Other plantations along Cane River weathered 5 years of sacrifice and uncertainty, outlasting the depressed cotton prices and tight credit aftermath of the Panic of 1837, and eventually cotton prices crept back up and the banks made cash available again for those felt to have a future. Their neighbors bounced back to pre-panic levels of production, and King Cotton reigned supreme. Relatives and neighbors reverted to their old ways, entertaining, holding soirees and hunts and horse races, as if the money worries of the last few years were too far away for anyone to remember. Cane River became truly joyous again, except for Rosedew. There always seemed to be too many things to worry about. Françoise looked over to Aureline,
her niece's small bow mouth moving with concentrated intensity, her voice pleasant enough. She had proven to be a devoted companion and a great comfort, attending Françoise through mourning, melancholy, and illness, trying to shoulder some of the responsibilities of Rosedew. But she was too tall and too plain, and had no land to attract a proper beau, as was essential at her age. Her age, Françoise thought. Aureline was getting older, 20, not yet married, and lovesick over a boy whom she had lost to a more spirited girl. He had been the only suitor Aureline encouraged, a seemingly sincere young man, who turned out to have le cœur comme un artichaut, a heart like an artichoke, with a leaf for everyone. He had paid court to a girl in Cloutierville, at the same time he charmed Aureline, and had recently announced his engagement to the other girl in the spring. Françoise could understand that her niece needed time to let her heart mend, but time was not on her side. If she reached 25 unmarried, her chance to be a bride was most likely gone. She might as well throw her corset on the armoire, prepare herself for the spinster's life. Françoise would miss Aureline's soothing presence when she married, but she wanted to see her safely matched and starting her own life. She determined to talk discreetly to her friends to unearth a suitable husband for Aureline. Françoise was more confident about her success in this arena than in dealing with the overseer. No doubt the overseer's requested audience today would be another in a constant string of complaints about surly negroes or missing livestock, or how much food each slave consumed, or broken tools. What was she to do about any of that? It was too overwhelming, the constant appeals and recitations of petty wrongs. The whole business of having to deal with an overseer was unseemly to begin with, and contrary to her upbringing. After a time, she had left this latest one to his own devices, or waited until her nephew Narcisse Frédieu or kinsman Eugène Dora came by and asked one of them to handle whatever needed looking after. For anything official that required writing, she sent word to Eugène Dora, and he took care of it. She was grateful that her kinsman had come to Cane River, and although she did not approve of how he consorted so intimately with negroes, she ignored that unpleasantness. She trusted him with her business affairs, and she enjoyed his company. She had stopped making the overseer account to her for punishment meted out in the field. If he had to give more than 20 lashes in order to ensure obedience, why should she question it? Monitoring the overseer's activities had been Louis's way, but Louis had died and left her alone. She did not want to know about these things. In some ways, it was a blessing that she did not get outside much any more, to see how the cabins needed whitewashing, or the barn had begun to lean at a curious angle, or how her beloved roses lost their petals early and meandered unsupervised. But she saw the evidence of leaks in the roof, when the constant dripping into the catch-pots in the corner of her own bedroom disturbed her sleep, and she could count the dwindling number of times meat was part of the meal. From time to time, Suzette approached her on behalf of someone in the quarter, pleading a case for this one or that one, about some specific injustice or cruelty. Françoise often felt that she was in the middle of squabbling children, each insisting on giving his or her particular interpretation of the same event, an event that didn't really matter anyway. All she cared about was that within her own household, the girl knew her place and the work got done. The day-to-day running of the house and grounds was left to Elizabeth, Suzette, and old Bertram. It was the best she could do. "The overseer's here, madame." Her girl's voice sounded wary. A stumpy man holding a soiled and misshapen hat in his hand followed Suzette into the darkened room. Françoise had a strong distaste for the overseer. He was uncouth, with a face chapped rough by the sun, an unwashed odor that preceded him, and no family connections to speak of. She didn't want him inside her house, let alone her bedroom. She would have rather had Narcisse or Eugène deal with him, but the overseer had been insistent that he speak to her immediately. Françoise heard Aureline quietly close her book. Her niece remained seated in the chair by the bed. Suzette disappeared.
"I hope your health is improved, madame,"
he began, standing a respectful distance from the bed, but filling the room nonetheless.
As well as can be expected. But my vitality comes and goes. You had an urgent matter that required my personal attention?
Yes, madame. The bank won't extend any more credit to us. We already let part of the South Field go last year. We need seed now, or we miss this planting too. I have a way out of our problem.
I'm listening, said Françoise, impatient with her dependence on this man.
The deaf and dumb girl has 3 mulattoes that would bring a decent price. If we sell them, we save the season, without losing any workers.
Aureline gasped. Oh, Françoise, there must be some other way, she said, interrupting, her voice shrill. It was unlike her.
Not Pamir's children.
I can get $200 for the oldest. With such a shortage on Cane River, even the little ones are fetching a good sum.
The overseer continued as if Aureline had not spoken.
They're banking on the future, he said with a wink. If we don't do this, we put the whole plantation at risk.
Françoise could picture their faces, 2 boys and a girl, mulattoes carrying Louise features. They used to try to hide the children from her when she went to the quarter, but she had seen them.
Most of the worth on Rosedew is tied up in the quarter. All you have to do, madame, is give me the go-ahead,
the overseer pressed.
I can take care of the rest.
And so, without wanting to remember their names, Françoise authorized the sale of first Paul, age 5, then Soleil, 3, and finally Mélantine, age 2, away from Rosedew. Once the slave sales began, the slow but steady outflow continued, 1 or 2 from the quarter each year. But Rosedew couldn't right itself. The smokehouse was never more than half full, and rations were reduced in both the big house and the quarter. Grass completely reclaimed the South Field. The year that cotton fell to less than 7 cents a pound, Françoise managed to arrange a match for Aureline to a poor young farmer from Lower Cane River. Her niece was 22. 2 weeks before the wedding, Françoise and Aureline sat in Françoise's bedroom, stitching items for Aureline's trousseau. Françoise began to cough, a long series of clipped strangles that seemed to feed on themselves, and Aureline threw aside her handiwork. "It pains me to go away and leave you," she said, easing Françoise's upper body forward and rubbing her back in firm, circular movements. "I'll be so far away."
"Only downriver. No farther than your cousin Narcisse," Françoise replied. "It is important to embrace the chance to marry when you have it."
"Monsieur Ferrier thinks I could learn to be a good wife to him. He says he enjoys my company."
Color dotted Aureline's pale cheeks.
"But it doesn't seem proper to leave you on Rosedew alone."
Françoise looked at the young woman she had raised. Aureline was a plain-featured woman, but devoted and as close to her as any daughter who would have been born of her own body. It was difficult to think of her niece paired to a man who worked with his hands, but the union was preferable to having Aureline adopt the hooded bonnet of spinsterhood, with ribbons that tied under the chin. Joseph Ferrier was a tall, long-limbed man, a welcome fit for Aureline's height, an outdoorsman with sure movements and sandy hair that fell into his eyes. He seemed good-natured and was solicitous of his mother. Both good signs, and he had appeared at once to be attracted to Aureline's quiet, obedient ways. At least someone found the girl attractive, Françoise thought. She didn't want to dwell on the fact that Ferrier was a small-time farmer, overreaching.
"My time is past," Françoise said. "Now we must secure the best position for you that we are able. Once I am gone, Rosedew will have to be sold. Perhaps your portion will allow you and Monsieur Ferrier to better your lot."
"Oui, Aunt Françoise," Aureline said respectfully. "I promise to come back to visit every week."
The wedding was a modest affair. When the ceremony was over, Aureline moved away from Rosedew to Ferrier's small farm, a bumpy step down from plantation life. Only Françoise d'Urban was left in the big house on Rosedew.
Françoise and her visitors and her servants. Chapter 7. In the 10 years following the death of Louis d'Herbane, everyone on Rosedew had learned to adjust to the hard luck that kept to the heels of the plantation, like a mean-spirited dog. Suzette endured, always standing, waiting to serve, without complaint. She had spent her entire life taking care of people who could not take care of themselves. She pretended to care about the knot of infirmities that tightened around Françoise. She pretended to care that Eugène Dorat brought little candies and trinkets from his store for Gérard and Philomène. As the children grew older, Eugène even gave Gérard a real carpenter's awl, the handle nicked and worn and the point dulled but still serviceable, and he often brought bits of calico for Philomène to patch a skirt or sew up a new Josie. Suzette pretended to care each week when Aureline confided during her visits how homesick she was for Rosedew and how worried she was about Françoise's physical decline. Since the birth of her children and the selling of her niece and nephews, Suzette had become unflinchingly certain about what mattered. All she really cared about now was her own family. Outside Françoise d'Herbane's bedroom, Suzette drew Gérard and Philomène close to her. She stooped low and whispered so only they could hear.
Philomène, you stay where Madame can see you in case she wakes. If she starts to fret, send Gérard to come find me.
You know you can count on me, Maman, Philomène said in the matter-of-fact way she had.
I can handle Madame by myself. Get her to calm down and do whatever I want.
Suzette stared at her daughter's serious face, then pinched her hard on the arm.
That is dangerous talk, and you must never say anything like it again.
Philomène looked surprised but not sorry.
Yes, Mama, she said at last.
Suzette hurriedly left the big house by the back door. Despite the gauzy shadows of haze across the evening sky, the full moon lit the way for Suzette's nightly journey to the quarter. As she began her walk, she reached into her apron pocket. Her fingers found the items she carried with her everywhere, the rosary Françoise d'Herbane had given her over a decade before, and the stiff scrap of tanned cowhide, a present from a young boy to a young girl who still had dreams. Only a few steps down the path, she suddenly turned and began to run back to the house, almost stumbling on a loose stone in the dark.
"Gérard, Philomène,"
Suzette whispered urgently into the stillness of the back room, opening her arms wide. They came to her, and she clutched her children, pressing them to her as tightly as she could. The boy's smell of Gérard mixed with the odor of wax from his lighting of the candles, and the sharp scent of lye soap from the supper dishes had found its way into Philomène's braided hair.
"My babies," she said.
Then, loosening her grip, she stepped back to put distance between herself and them. To Philomène she said,
"Why can't you understand the danger?"
"I will send for you if Madame stirs," Philomène said. "Please do not worry, Mama."
Suzette felt their eyes looking after her as she went out again into the night. Sometimes she couldn't get enough of Gérard and Philomène. Other times she couldn't attach herself to them at all, as if they were already gone. Her children were house-raised, she thought. Maybe she could keep them safer than Palmyre's children. Suzette was still small, and she was still pretty. It was easy to trace in her facial features and body proportions the African ancestors on her mother's side and the stray drops of Caddo Indian from her father. For a time, the spicy snap of her name and the way she had been brought up had tricked her into believing that she was also partly colored Creole, immune. At 25, she saw more clearly now. The open-faced sweetness of her youth had been replaced by a nagging vagueness that came and went of its own accord, and although she still claimed a child's distinction of soft brown eyes too big for her face, the shimmering of possibilities was no longer reflected there. The few chickens stirring around the henhouse scattered as she walked into their domain, and she clucked at them softly. They were used to her. The straw pricked at her fingers as she felt around in the setting beds. She took only 2 eggs, putting them in her apron pocket. After pulling the door shut behind her and fastening the latch, she kept on the path to the cookhouse. 3 buttermilk biscuits were hidden in the pantry where she had left them this morning, wrapped in a white rag. She put those in her other pocket, along with a jar she had filled with molasses and a small kitchen knife. Instead of the footpath that would take her past the overseer's house, Suzette cut through a small patch of pines to approach the quarter from behind. She went to see her father first, careful to step around the rotted planks on the porch. The place held the tight, close odor of mold and waste. The cabin had not been whitewashed for 3 planting seasons, and the floors had not been limed for well over a year. "How is he?" Suzette whispered to Elizabeth as she came through the door. A small fire burned in the fireplace and threw patterns of light and dark around the room, highlighting the spare furnishings. There were 2 pallets at opposite corners, and 3 seats at a small table set with wooden plates and several drinking gourds. Only Gerasim, Elizabeth, and Solataire lived in the cabin now. Gerasim breathed loudly, his head protruding from a ragged gray blanket on the pallet, his hair long and wild, tangled and sweat-soaked on the log pillow. Elizabeth sat by his side on a pine stump. "Better," Elizabeth said. "I salved the cuts."